Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 400. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about pirates and jungle and a great big canal as we go to Panama. Welcome to the 400th episode of the Amateur Traveler. I want to thank all of you who've been listening for some time, but this is just going to be a regular show because putting out content on a regular basis about cool destinations is what we do. Before we get into the interview for this episode, I do have two news stories for you. There's an interesting new alternative to Airbnb called Flat Club, which is based in the UK. What they provide is an Airbnb experience, but you can choose a membership that is limited, for instance, to the university where you went to, so you would only stay with alumni or some other group that with a closed membership to provide for a safer sharing experience. And then I love this story from the Huffington Post. Would you pay nearly $10 for a plain old cup of coffee at a particular cafe in France? That's how much the coffee will cost you unless you use the magic words hello and please, according to a sign. A typical cup of coffee will cost you $2, but if you fail to say bonjour or s'il vous plaît, there will be $4 for skipping each word. For links to both of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome back Chandra from London, who's come to talk to us about Panama. Chandra, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Chris. It's good to be back.
And I say welcome back to the show because Chandra has been on before talking about a road trip in southern Israel, of all places. So you'll have to go back and listen to that episode as well. But we have talked about Panama on the show, but we've talked about it like a lot of American tourists do Panama, which is you are on a boat and you get off the boat. Actually, I don't even know if I stepped foot in Panama. I guess I did on the way to a bus, but that was my trip. You actually spent some time there.
Yeah, that's right. In October this year, we did, actually it was part of a larger 3-week trip, and we split our time in between Panama and Costa Rica, actually. And part of it was a cruise, although not your traditional type of cruise. It was focused on the wildlife. And then as part of that, we decided to spend a week beforehand in Panama.
Now, Costa Rica, a very typical destination. Panama, less so, even though there's quite a good infrastructure in Panama. So what led you to spend more time in Panama?
Well, the cruise started in Panama, and I mean, we picked the cruise first, and that was on Silver Sea Silver Explorer, which is on, they're one of their sort of adventure discovery explorer ships. Mm-hmm. I think it's more well known for the, it does trips in the Arctic and Antarctic, but sort of as a transition trip, it had to go through the Panama Canal, and so they built a little 1-week nature-focused itinerary around that, and I saw that itinerary and said, ooh, that looks really interesting, and then well, I've never been to Panama before, so I guess we ought to spend a week there. And then, of course, we have to have at least a week in Costa Rica. And the next thing I know, we're looking at a 3-week trip. So mostly just curiosity was what led us to go ahead and start there.
Excellent. And we're going to talk more about Panama, but I want to talk a little bit about the cruise first. So when you talk about that cruise line, we're talking about a smaller boat, less focused on the midnight buffet, and not a budget cruise.
Right. Now, it was a very expensive cruise, but there were 100. People can go look it up. That is not our usual travel budget, but this was an early 10-year wedding anniversary present, so we kind of splashed out much more than we usually would have. But there's about 100, I think, on our trip. It depends on how full the trip is. This was a full trip, and there was 122 people on board, so a very small ship. And as a result, you can kind of get back in. Like I said, the focus was on the nature. So after going through the Panama Canal, we went over to the Darien.
Darien Gap.
Yeah. Since we were getting there by sea, we actually explored like one of the mangrove forests that were right there and had a botched visit to an Embrera village. And then from there, we went to the Isla de Cueva, the Pearl Islands, which is just in the Gulf of Panama. And then from there, we were into Costa Rica for stops near the Corcovado National Park, the Golfo Dolce, and then Manuel Antonio National Park before stopping off in Costa Rica.
So on the west coast.
Yeah, exactly. So we were on the Pacific side after transiting the canal.
Let's go back to that botched visit. What was that?
Well, whenever we booked the cruise, all we knew was kind of the places that it was stopping. We didn't know what activities that they would have for us. And unlike your more traditional cruises, all of your expeditions and your day trips are included. So when we booked the cruise, we didn't really know, but I saw Darien Jungle on the itinerary, and that was one of the things that sold it for me, because it's of course a very difficult place to get to, and tourism is not exactly encouraged into that corner of the world. So that was one of the key drivers. Well, not until a couple of days before we left on the larger trip did we get the documents through that listed everything that they had planned for us. And we noticed that that day they had decided to visit a native village. And I'm going to talk about a successful visit to a native village as part of what we did in Panama, but this one was a botched one. I mean, first of all, we arrived there in the afternoon, and as I guess I should probably say, October is the rainy season in both Panama and Costa Rica, and we knew that going in, and usually, and that's very doable, or at least it was fine for us. It meant that you have beautiful mornings, and then about 2, 2:30 p.m., you get a thunderstorm, and the thunderstorm can last anywhere from sort of half an hour, 45 minutes to the rest of the afternoon. You never really know until you get into it. So whoever was planning the itinerary at Silver Sea, no doubt they had very good intentions, but they had us arriving at about noon, which means by the time we all got on the boats, it was
torrential downpour.
Torrential downpour. In fact, it was really funny, and they had to get some local craft to come up to the ship in order to get everybody to go out into the dairy, into the landing site where we're going to visit the village. And as they pulled up and as it started to rain, we were standing out on our balcony kind of watching the excitement. And they were already bailing.
Oh my gosh.
The local craft as they pulled up to the boat. I mean, it was a great adventure. I mean, it's something that we'll probably talk about for the rest of our lives. And it was certainly safe. They wouldn't have put people in the boat, has it not been safe. But it certainly didn't look all that encouraging. So it was raining, so it wasn't really the best time. And so we couldn't really interact. They couldn't do the activities that they wanted us to do with the people. I mean, the Indian village came down to the landing site rather than us trekking through the forest to get to them, which was really kind. But it was just overall, just the weather made for a really sort of muddy, nasty, just because you're in the middle of the jungle, and when things get wet, everything gets dirty. So it was just not really very comfortable trip, which would have been fun, I think, had we been allowed to sort of wander off on our own. But seeing as we were supposed to be contained and we're supposed to interact with these villagers who are as sort of wet and miserable as we were, it wasn't the best day of the trip. But like I said, it's a good story in hindsight.
And if people don't know, we're talking about the area where the Pan American Highway doesn't go through. It's the one spot from the tip of southern South America to northern North America where there is a break in the highway because it's just too wet and just too much jungle. We've actually done a separate episode on just the Darien Gap and wonderful stories about big tarantulas, but we'll let people listen to that separately. But we want to then go back to your trip, and what did you see, and what do you recommend we see in Panama, especially off the trip on an independent travel?
Sure. So if you're coming into Panama, you're going to land at the Panama City Airport. And there's only one international airport in Panama. And if you're coming from the U.S., I think United has direct flights from several different places. I think some of the people we met said that they had traveled through Atlanta, Houston, Los Angeles, those sorts of places had direct flights. Coming from London, we came through Madrid, actually. And there were quite a lot of mainland Spanish travelers in Panama. I was surprised. Not, perhaps shouldn't have been, given the country's history. But so you land in Panama City, and then from there, we went into Panama City and spent a couple of days there. And of course, Panama City it's a massive big city. And it's got all of your standard sort of tourist infrastructure. And it's probably the easiest place to start from.
And what did you do in Panama City?
Right. We stayed at, actually, I found a really good deal. And if you look on the internet, because the worldwide recession has hit Panama, not quite as hard as it's hit Europe and the U.S., but tourism numbers are down in Panama. And this was a recurring theme that we heard from everybody that we spoke to. And traveling in the rainy season, it was, you know, tourism numbers were even sort of lower than that, really, to be expected. So if you look around, you can usually get quite a good number of deals. A lot of the hotels will throw in a day tour that they'll organize for you. So we found one of those. We found a really nice deal through one of the nicer hotels. And they included a half-day tour of Panama City, what they call Panama City Old and New. And that was with Ancon Expeditions, who do mostly nature trips, but they recently started doing this more, I don't want to call it a traditional, but sort of a more city-focused tour. So our guide was excellent. His name was Hernan, and he actually is sort of a long line of sociological. His mother was one of the first sociologists and archaeologists to study the native Pan-American peoples. So he had a lot of really good information to share for us. And so we started, so after flying in, sort of spent the night, got up early the next morning, and then we went out to Old Panama City. I think one thing that people ought to realize is that the modern Panama City is actually the third incarnation of Panama City. And this is a great place to start, and it really kind of gives you a sense of the history of the region as a whole. Because, of course, one of the reasons that Panama is the way it is because, well, originally the Spanish were looking for a route. Well, Christopher Columbus was looking for a route into the East Indies. And, of course, this landmass is in the way. And on his fourth journey, actually came into Panama. That was sort of the beginning of the Spanish. So originally, all of the Spanish enclaves were on the Atlantic side, but Panama City was on the Pacific side, where they would bring a lot of the gold in from Lima and the outposts in what is now Colombia. So the original Panama City is way out, and it's only ruins because it was sacked by Henry Morgan in the 1600s.
The English pirate.
Yeah, the English pirate. So when the English and the Spanish were playing.
Privateer, let's say. I'm not sure which he was, but.
Well, they say he was one of the most successful privateers. He did have a letter mark from Queen Elizabeth.
Okay.
And he actually ended up, I think he died in Jamaica. He was governor there. So when he got back from sacking Panama, effectively, and wreaking havoc on Spanish trade, he was knighted and given lots of government positions for the rest of his career. So unlike a lot of pirates, he actually ended up to be quite a respectable fellow. The oldest Panama City was really just a waypost originally for the Spanish to sort of land their gold, and then they would take it overland to the Atlantic side and then to be offloaded to Spanish proper on the galleons. So the old Panama City is now ruins, having been sacked by Henry Morgan. And so we went out and we spent the morning, part of the morning, a couple of hours at the ruins. And there's actually on the way, at the very beginning of the ruins, as you sort of get out of Panama City, and it's a good 10-15 minute drive from modern day downtown Panama City, and you will want to drive. Panama is not, I mean, there are some public transportation, but not a lot of it, and it's very, very difficult to get around on their public transportation if you don't speak Spanish. They're in the process of improving that. But if you're a non-Spanish speaker, the best thing to do is either to get a taxi, and taxis are plentiful
and very easily found in downtown Panama City, or can get a guide or rent a car if you were really ambitious. I wouldn't drive in Panama. But people perhaps who are a little bit more comfortable with chaotic roads could probably manage it. And the signs aren't great, so you would be guessing quite a bit. Anyway, so you need to drive out to the old ruins, about 10, 15 minutes to the west of main Panama City. And the ruins are actually pretty extensive. I mean, there's not a whole lot that's left standing there, just because a lot of it had been sort of carted off to be used as building materials in other places. But there's still quite a bit standing. There's the old tower. There's significant portions of an old abbey that are still left. So it's a really cool place to kind of poke around. And if you go with a guide or with a very detailed printed guide, either an in-person live guide or like a printed guide, they'll point out a lot of things that aren't necessarily obvious, like and all the history. So when we were standing up in the tower, for example, to have sort of the battle, the march for Henry Morgan sort of described to us was actually really pretty fantastic. And it gave you a sense of the way topology, the landscape, really affects the whole history of the country has developed.
Sure.
So that was really quite cool. So we spent a good couple of hours there, and there's actually a really good museum. Just as you get into the ruins themselves, there's a little place where you go in and you pay for your ticket to get in, because it is a place that you have to pay to get in. And there's actually a really great little museum there. Again, everything is signed in Spanish, very little in English, but it's pretty self-explanatory even if you don't speak Spanish or if you're not with a Spanish speaker. And I think that there's like little tours that the museum does in both Spanish and English a couple of times, I think twice a day, for people who want to do that. But I do recommend going to the museum first, because it also gives a lot of the history. And if you go soon, sometime in the next year or so, there should still be there a really cool exhibit on Balboa, the Spanish crusaders. This September was the 500th anniversary of Balboa discovering, quote unquote, the Pacific. So there's quite a lot happening in Panama City around that anniversary. And of course, he did that, rumor has it, at the site of the old ruined Panama City.
Excellent. You mentioned you went in the rainy season. Now, my impression is, I mean, they built the canal there not just because it's a narrow part, but because there is tremendous amounts of rain that power the canal, most of the canal being done with gravity. So is there a dry season, or is there a rainy season and a less rainy season?
From what I gather, well, it depends on where you are. In the central part, where we spent most of our time, and certainly in the western part as you go closer towards Colombia, it is pretty much wet and wetter season. Okay. There are some places more towards, and not really as far as Costa Rica, but some of the other provinces, it does get a little bit dry, where the mountains get a little bit steeper and you do get a little bit stress, a little bit of a rain shadow, you know, down by the Mosquito Gulf before you get to sort of Bocas. There is some parts of the country that are dry, but yeah, I mean, this is the tropics, so it is wet and wetter. So from that perspective, it didn't really faze us very much.
Excellent. Where to next?
We drove back through New Panama City to what they call Casca Viejo or Casca Antigua, which is the second incarnation of Panama City. So you have the old ruined after Henry Morgan sacked it. I think the Spanish decided that maybe we ought to rethink our location here a little bit. And for people who don't know the story, Henry Morgan didn't sack it from the ocean side, because that was actually pretty well fortified. What he did is he landed at Portobello, which I'm going to talk about later, and then marched his people overland and attacked Panama City from the overland side, which they weren't expecting, even though they'd had rumor that he was coming, but they really weren't prepared. You know, their fortifications, their defenses weren't really prepared to defend the city from the land side, because they weren't. Nobody would have thought that anybody would be crazy enough to do that. So after Henry Morgan sacks the city, they relocated it over to sort of the other side of the little bay there, which is a little bit easier. It's got a big hill in the back of it, Ancon Hill, which plays a prominent role in the story of the Panama Canal and the building, the French endeavors in particular to build the Panama Canal. So Ancon Hill is sort of at the back of it, which makes it a little bit better position strategically. So it's just on the other side of the little bay. with Panama City's the third incarnation of Panama City in the middle. So we went around to the other side of the bay to Casca Viejo, Casca Antigua, depending on who you ask. It's called both of those. So again, sort of driving another sort of 15, 20 minutes over to the other side, where we parked and got out on foot. You can drive in the old city, what they call the old city, as opposed to the ruined city. The streets are very narrow. It's, if you think of it a little bit like some of the downtown, the small cities in Spain, the streets are very, very narrow.
Not built for cars.
Built long before cars were there, and cobblestones and all that. So we parked just outside, and then we got out, and we walked about a bit. Before we got there, our guide, Hernan, actually apologized, saying, look, we're in the process of renovating this old downtown area, but it's not quite there yet. And I actually thought that made it much more interesting, personally. I'm glad to see, because the two old Panama City sites, the ruins and Casca Viejo, are UNESCO World Heritage Sites. And unfortunately for Panama, both of their UNESCO World Heritage Sites, the two Panama cities and then the other one, which is San Lorenzo and Portobello, which I'll talk about a little bit later on, they're the two major UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Panama, and both of them are on the endangered list. They clearly kind of focus their efforts on the two Panama City sites to try to remove that designation, because as you can imagine, that's not the greatest PR for them.
Well, also, if they drop off the list, if they don't take care of them, and then they stop getting money from UNESCO, so...
Exactly. So it's a really interesting site. So they were in the middle of modernizing it, which I thought actually, for pictures anyway, it made it absolutely fantastic. And it was really interesting because some of these buildings are very old indeed. And for anybody who knows the story of the building of the Panama Canal in the time that the French were here, this would have been the city that de Lesseps visited. So it's got a lot of that old colonial architecture. With the wrought iron and the three-story wooden and stucco houses painted bright colors. Some of them have been completely refurbished and are beautiful, and some of them are peeling and look like they're going to fall down any second now, with wires that are sort of jerry-rigged from the lamp post across the street. And yeah, so it's a really interesting place. And it's very clear that it's sort of undergoing this modernization. And if you talk to people that live there, and we did get a chance to speak with some of the locals, there's really mixed feelings about it. Some people are very excited because it used to be known as an area that was very high in crime. In fact, tourists used to be heavily discouraged from going into Casca Viejo because of the crime. Nowadays, that's not the case. I mean, we walked around, you know, after Hernan left us, we walked around perfectly happily by ourselves and were never bothered. There were plenty of other locals doing the same. So I think anybody who hears the word Panama City and thinks, ooh, dangerous, ooh, crime.
Yeah, we were going to get to that.
Yeah, I think that's a very antiquated view. And I mean, it's a big city, and there are places in London I wouldn't walk around in after
I think
dark.
What I mostly had heard about Panama City is maybe not to go out at night. I don't know if that's still the case or not, but...
We didn't go out at night in Casca Viejo, but we did go out at night in downtown Panama City, and again, weren't bothered at all. I mean, the only time we got bothered was a bat flying out of a tree within sort of 6 inches of my left ear and sort of up under the eaves of one of the building, and that was the worst that happened to us. So, I mean, your mileage may vary, as with anything, but I really think a lot of the crime reputation for Panama, it doesn't necessarily apply today.
Excellent.
So anyway, so in Casca Antigua, and this is basically where a lot of the life of the city is. There's a lot of really galleries, lots of little cafes. You've got the Interoceanic Museum there, which is the museum that talks about particularly the French building of the Panama Canal. And again, because of the Balboa anniversary, also had a huge exhibit on Balboa, which was actually focused on maps, which was really quite cool. So I don't know how long that exhibit would be on, certainly for the next year or so, but it was really quite cool. And so you can just kind of walk around. There's quite a few old churches that are back in there that are all colonial style, Spanish colonial style churches, which are really beautiful. Some ruined Jesuit colleges, I guess, for lack of a better word, that are back in there that are really quite neat. And again, everything's starting to clean up. And then, of course, there's Panama City, the modern city itself. And it is a high-rise city. It actually reminded me of like a cross between Miami and Singapore. Clearly not as clean, as Singapore. In fact, the other danger aside from low-flying bats walking around in the evening are the fact that the sidewalks are pretty potholed. And the potholes can be pretty deep if you step in one. I mean, it can come up over your ankle. So you want to be, that would be, I think, more the danger walking around at night, is you really have to kind of watch your step more than anything else. And it's got your big chain hotels. It's got, actually, we saw a DJI Fridays there, which we were not expecting. And it's got cuisine from all over the world. I mean, if you want Mexican cuisine, you can have Mexican cuisine. You can have Italian. You can have Greek. You can have Lebanese. I mean, anybody and everybody that's there. And I think that's one of the things that actually makes Panama and Panama City in particular very interesting, is because it's been the crossroads of the world for so long. Everybody who's anybody has an outpost there. I mean, there's Chinese who have been there since the late 1800s, who came when the French originally built the canal, who stayed. It's a huge, huge mixing pot. And that makes for really interesting people, because I think I was reading, must have been one of the fact books, the CIA fact book or the World Bank fact book, that said that something like 96% of the population in Panama self-described themselves as mixed race. So it's a really very vibrant place. And if you go out in Casquivejo, the live music scene is really quite fantastic. So you can easily spend a couple of days with the museums and the history there. I wish we would have actually had longer. I wish we would have done a full half day at the ruins, because we could have crawled over those things for even more hours than we did. And then sort of another half day in a full half day in Casquivejo, just sort of poking around.
Excellent.
The other places, if you get out of Panama City, the other place that's sort of central is Portobello and San Lorenzo. It's sort of the opposite end of the story. So if you drive back towards the Atlantic side on the main highway there that goes between Colón, which is the outpost for the current port, you can go back through some really not quite great roads to Portobello and San Lorenzo, which were the Spanish outposts on the Atlantic side. And again, we did this. I found actually a really cool guide company called Barefoot Panama. And we did a day trip with them because we got on the cruise ship in Cologne. So we overnighted in Cologne, which ordinarily I wouldn't recommend that anybody do. There's actually very little in Cologne itself. Your guidebooks are absolutely spot on right. about that part. And in fact, Jeff, one of our guides from Barefoot Panama, said that apparently there's a series of scenes, I think, in Quantum of Solace that's supposed to be Haiti. Well, they filmed those scenes in Cologne.
Okay.
Yeah, there's two sides to Cologne. There's what they call the free port, which is the cargo port, and it's sort of a customs free trade zone. And then there's the city where the workers live. And you can't really get into the goods port because, well, why would you want to? It's not really geared up for shopping, although they're trying to change that. And then the rest of the city, like I said, we just kind of drove through it. And third world doesn't really even begin to describe it. When you come from Panama City, which is very modern and fairly clean, relatively, and clearly sort of geared up for tourists and very easy to get around, I mean, Cologne is like coming into a whole nother world. So if you use Cologne as a home base, which is actually really quite good for, you want to stay on the outskirts and in one of the Western hotels. Don't be getting off-piste in Cologne. That's not really a good place to do that.
And when you did the guide with Barefoot Panama, did you go into Cologne then?
Well, we needed to drive through Cologne to get to the cruise port.
Got it. Okay.
So we did go through Cologne, although we didn't stop. In theory, the hotel that we stayed in, which was just a Sheraton hotel, was within walking distance of one of the rail stations for the Panama Canal Railway. We kind of took one look at what we were going to have to walk through and decided maybe we would see that from the car.
Got it. And this is the railway that predates the canal.
Actually, this is the new railway, because when they built the canal, they had to move the railway.
Got it. Okay.
So it is the post-1913 or post-1905, whenever I forget which day they actually moved the railway. But the terminus station is the same as what it was during French time. And actually, it's really quite sad, Cologne, because you can see at the root of that, the architecture, aside from the dirt and the peeling paint and the very bad repair, Some of the buildings still had some of their original wrought iron fittings and could have been really very stunning. You kind of get a feeling of that sort of old world elegance sort of underneath all of the dilapidation. So if they ever do decide to spend some money in Cologne, it could be quite a lovely city, but as of today, it's not. So from Cologne, you can drive to, again, it's the other sort of twin UNESCO World Heritage sites. They're two separate sites, but they're UNESCO considers them as one, which is Fort San Lorenzo and Portobello. Fort San Lorenzo is the oldest Atlantic side Spanish port, and again, it's only in ruins. And to get there, you from Cologne, you have to drive across the Panama Canal to get there. And when they told me that, I thought like a bridge up and over, like the Bridge of the Americas or the Centenary Bridge or something like that goes sort of high up and over. That's not how it works. And what you're on is basically a metal track that's literally just wide enough for one car to pass that actually goes in front of the Gatun locks, the lock gates.
Oh, this is the one that's the drawbridge?
Yeah, it's like a little metal drawbridge.
Okay.
That sort of and it lifts up whenever they're going to let a ship in or out. So you're very dependent to get to San Lorenzo on the shipping times.
Right.
So if you have good timing, like what we did, you just pull up and you drive straight across. I was not expecting to drive right in front of these lock gates, and you're sort of 10 feet from these massive ships going through the canal. So that was our introduction to the Panama Canal. It was actually really quite cool. Mm. So from there, you drive through the jungle. It's called the Chagres National Park. Mm-hmm. You drive through Chagres National Park to get to Fort San Lorenzo. But before you come to Fort San Lorenzo, you hit Fort Sherman, which was a huge surprise to us. I wasn't really expecting that. It's the old U.S. military base. Mm-hmm. Went from the U.S. occupation of the canal zone, and it has basically been left to go to ruins. There is a military checkpost that's there, so if you do decide to go to Fort San Lorenzo, good idea to be going with somebody who speaks enough Spanish to either A, have a Panamanian ID that they can register at the gates, or blag your way through the army checkpoint, which is totally doable from what I gather from other independent tourists who do it. But you do have to sort of check in and clear this Panamanian military checkpoint. Mm-hmm. And then you drive through this ruined American outpost, which was surreal. And when we were there, and at the back of the post is actually a modern day marina, which they've kept up, and it's got a restaurant and that sort of thing. But it was to have seen the old, old ruins, then to be driving through these ruins from the 1960s, 1970s. It was abandoned in the 90s, but most of the construction is sort of 1960s, 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
With the Panama shipping in the background and the Panamanian military all around you, and like this little, it reminded me of being in Florida in some of the old 1960s, 1970s developments in Florida. It was really bizarre. So you pass through Fort Sherman, and about 10, 15 minutes later, going through the, again, so you're still in the national park, you get to San Lorenzo, which is on this rocky outcropping at the mouth of the Chagres River, where these ruins are, which is the old Spanish fort. And the surroundings are absolutely stunning. And apparently at the base of that cliff is some really quite good scuba diving. And there's an archaeological park also at the ocean bed on the base of that cliff, where they believe that they found one of the ships from Henry Morgan that had crashed on a reef as they attacked Fort San Lorenzo before they marched overland to Panama City. So Fort San Lorenzo was supposed to guard the mouth of the Chagres River, which was one of the ways that they brought the gold from the Atlantic side. So they would march up to the Chagres River and then take the Chagres River by boat out to Fort San Lorenzo. It's really quite a cool space, but I can see why it's endangered, because as far as I can tell, they've done nothing with it. Hmm. There's some scaffolding up, but not a lot. We were probably there for an hour and a half, and we traipsed over most of it. There's nothing there. There's not a restroom, not a cafe, literally nothing. And while we were there, the only other creature out with us with the butterflies and the buzzards. So it's a really interesting place to be. It can be quite eerie.
Well, the buzzards would would do that for you.
Yeah. I mean, they are beautiful birds. They're really beautiful when they fly, but it's quite a surreal place. So then you get back in the car, you drive back through the national park, back through Fort Sherman, and then around to the very far other side of the bay to Portobello, which was the second place where the Spanish had their forts. And the town of Portobello itself is actually, there's still a little town there, mm-hmm. which is great, but it's a fairly small town, a couple of hundred people. And then in the middle of the town is the old ruined fort. So it's in a little bit better condition than what San Lorenzo is, but not by a whole lot. The old customs house, which is where the gold would have been stored before it was loaded onto the ships, is in really bad condition. They've got a little museum in there, not really much to look at. I wouldn't bother if I were with anyone else. But you'll need to speak Spanish or go through tour charades to get your ticket unless you're with somebody who speaks Spanish. We speak fairly decent Spanish. We can make ourselves understood. Mm-hmm. But so we were okay. But if you speak no Spanish whatsoever, you may find yourself resorting to tourist charades most of the time.
and that works too. You hand them money, they probably know what you want. So
if you're comfortable in tourist charades, knock yourself out. And again, people there are pretty easygoing.
Right.
I mean, they're not. If you try, they'll meet you as far as they can, and you'll end up with it. I mean, there was a lady who was outside selling green coconuts, so she would chop the top off with a machete, stick a straw in it, and hand it to you. Mm. So if you wave sort of a dollar bill at her, mm-hmm. and you pointed the coconuts, she got the hint.
And you mentioned dollar bill. We didn't actually mention that you can get by in dollars still in Panama.
Absolutely. In fact, the only paper money they have is American dollars. They have what they call balboas, mm-hmm. but it's all coins. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, when we got change back, although most the unit of currency seems to be a dollar, mm-hmm. very little that we found. Most everything, especially if you're eating street food or if you're just out and about outside of Panama City, if you ask a foreigner or if you ask a local and you're a foreigner for a price, it's usually going to be $1. Sometimes $2. It seems to be their sort of default price for foreigners for a lot of things.
Before we leave the forts, the one picture that you had that I thought was the most interesting was the old rusty cannons still sitting in a row, ready to protect the fort from invasion by English pirates or whoever, but they never took those away. They just sat there in place and rusted away.
Yeah, basically. And they've been dredging up those cannons from the bay, particularly around Portobello. In fact, all of the cannons that are in the fort of Portobello are cannons that they've dredged up from the bay.
Interesting.
And in fact, Portobello in Portuguese means beautiful bay. And if you see it, it's a very apt description. It's beautiful. And if you're into diving or snorkeling, apparently there's a reef on the opposite side of the bay where some of the old cannons and things have now had stuff sort of accrete and grow on them. Some quite good underwater activities there. And in fact, what I thought was really interesting in Portobello in the old fort is, in addition to the bricks and the rocks and things that they used to build the fort, they also used coral.
Oh, sure.
So as you walk around, you see bits of coral that have been stuck into the walls, brain coral or fan coral, and it's very obviously coral. And it was a bit odd the first time I noticed it, but then again, you notice, and they've very much used local building materials mm-hmm. when they first put that together. And I think the stone over the top is 1758 is when that site dates from. So after Henry Morgan sacked San Lorenzo, they moved Panama City, they moved their central storage point, their central Atlantic shipping point, to Portobello.
Excellent.
One other place in Portobello that people definitely don't want to miss is the church. The Church mm-hmm. of San Felipe, which is where they've got a local, it's sort of a local religious symbol, which is the Black Christ. Mm-hmm. It's a statue of Jesus Christ, but it's in dark wood. Mm-hmm. And they suspect that it came over, that was carved in Spain and brought over from Spain. But because a large proportion of the population on the Atlantic side, the Caribbean side of Panamanian is black descent from mm-hmm. Slavery didn't have as much of a foothold in Panama as it did in some of the other places in Central America and the Caribbean, but there was an attempt, a half-hearted attempt by the Spanish.
Well, it wouldn't have been as good a place to try and run a plantation, which is one of the reasons why you wouldn't have quite the impact of slavery in that area as you would in places like Cuba, obviously.
Exactly. And this isn't, I mean, it's not farming country.
No,
this
no.
I mean, it's marsh lands. And in this corner of Panama, there is a large Afro-Caribbean influence. Mm-hmm. And so this Black Christ has developed this following. And it's the center of a huge festival that was actually on 4 days after we were there, which I was gutted about. I wish I would have timed that a little bit better. So it's around the 21st of October every year. And they were just starting to set up for the festival while we were there. And they had a lot of the robes and things that they had dressed the statue in, and they did this big parade. So it's definitely worth stopping in. But the church, which is otherwise pretty unremarkable, is worth it to go in to see the Black Christ.
Excellent.
I think the other place that's worth a mention is the Sobradinho National Park, which is the national park that is covering most of the old canal zone and most of the old rainforest that's left. Part of Sobradinho National Park actually goes into Panama City. So you have a rainforest in the city, effectively, in downtown Panama City. Mm-hmm. So it's quite an interesting place. But in the middle of Sobradinho National Park is Lake Gatun, which is the lake that was formed when they dammed the Chagres River to run the canal.
Right.
That's where we had our successful Indian village visit. And I had a lot of the particularly cruise line tour companies make a big deal about visiting an Indian village. And because of my background and because of where I'm from Oklahoma originally, I've seen indigenous cultures exploited to an extent that makes me personally uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So I was a little bit hesitant going in about one of these, and I'd email, and that's how actually I got in touch with Barefoot Panama. The guys that run that, Jeff and Kevin, are amazing guys. But I was emailing Kevin actually before we left, and I said, this is what I've heard, I'm not really sure what kind of village do you visit and that sort of thing. And he really set my mind at ease that it is a village that's real. It is a village where people live, and it was a very authentic experience. I was really grateful for that. So we got out of the car and got into a rather rickety little boat and boated across Lake Gatun to the village. So it's only accessible by boat. It's not accessible from the land side. He had warned us that since it was a village where people lived and worked, that a lot of the villagers would be at work, seeing as how our visit at this stage was on a Wednesday afternoon. It was the only afternoon that we got where it didn't rain. So we got really, really lucky with the weather on that day. So yeah, so we visited the village, and we actually got to spend a little bit of time with the villagers, mostly women who were there. We got to look at their handicrafts, which are beautiful. And it was a Wunan village. So they had originally come from the Darien. But when they made Lake Gatun, the Americans did in the early 1900s, this tribe decided that they wanted to go ahead and move to be closer to the canal for economic reasons, but they still wanted to continue their way of life. So they managed to talk the Americans into allowing them this little outpost. And eventually, actually, and it was this village that became trainers for the American Army in jungle survival training.
Oh, interesting. Sure. They did training for years in Panama.
Exactly. So it was this village that provided a lot of the know-how and a lot of the trainers. Actually, so it's a contingent of American troops would come to the village, would stay there, and then use that as their outpost to do their jungle survival training. So when the Americans left, this village, which is actually a fairly large village, about 60 people, kind of had a choice. Did they go back to the Darien? Because they weren't super keen about, you know, they'd had a really good relationship with the Americans, apparently. And so they were very pleased that we were there, even though we live in London. My husband and I are American. They had a choice. Were they going to go back or were they going to stay? Some of the village did decide to go back, but there was a contingent of them that decided to stay and see how the transition would work for them. And it's been, from what I gather from them and from Kevin, who told us most of their story, it's been a pretty mixed bag. On the one hand, it's much easier for them to get jobs because they are so close to Panama City, and education for their kids. But on the other hand, like with a lot of indigenous peoples, their land rights aren't always recognized. And they often get in quite difficult legal battles with the government to try to recognize their way of life and to protect their culture and protect their land from incursion. So it's a bit of a mixed bag for them. But it was a wonderful visit, and it was nice to sort of see it away from the trappings. You know, they weren't presenting us what they thought we wanted to see. We just sort of turned up on their average day. And I was really glad that we had Kevin, who knew that the village clearly had very good connections with them and was really willing to help them tell their story in a very accessible yet honest way. And I really appreciated that.
Excellent. What surprised you about Panama?
I was surprised at the cultural diversity, which says a lot considering my day-to-day place of living is London, which is also a very diverse place. But I was just surprised at the diversity of people there. I mean, after having been there, the fact that 96% of people describe themselves as mixed race didn't surprise me at all. I mean, that made a lot of sense. And they very much pride themselves on that. That surprised me. I think the other thing that surprised me was just how easy it was. I had prepared myself mentally for a trip that was going to be going through some very crime-ridden, poverty-ridden areas. And yes, there is poverty. I think I talk about in the blog about the Gini coefficient, which is a measure of inequality, is huge. I mean, you've got people living in these penthouse apartments that are state-of-the-art that cost a fraction of what they would certainly in Europe versus people who are living quite an eager existence in some place like Cologne or some of the little villages that we drove through between Cologne and San Lorenzo or Puerto Bello. The discrepancy between the very rich and the very poor is much wider than almost anywhere else I've ever been. That surprised me. The other thing that surprised me was just how friendly everybody was. We didn't meet anyone who was certainly any ruder than what I would come across in my average day in London. And most people were willing with a smile, even if our Spanish wasn't up to scratch and their English wasn't up to scratch, we always were able to get around and get about. And the amount of laughter we heard from the locals was amazing. It's clearly a place where people are very proud of their country. Yeah, it was a very joyful place, a surprisingly joyful place.
Excellent. You're standing in the most pretty spot you saw in Panama. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
That bay in San Lorenzo on that outcropping with the dense forest, because now the forest has been allowed to grow back with the Chagres River coming out and it just being so peaceful. You're shielded from and by an outcropping, so you're shielded from all the busyness of the port of Cologne where the Panama Canal starts. And with nobody else around and with the ruins, it's like you can kind of start to see why some of the Spaniards may have wanted to stay, because it is beautiful. It's a really, really beautiful spot, just with the combinations of the intense greens and the intense blue of the sea, with all this history around you, is amazing.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say, only in Panama.
Everything costing a dollar.
Yeah, yeah.
You sort of the coconut for a dollar, the museum entrance tickets for a dollar, everything for a dollar.
And you mentioned street food was often a dollar or $2. What kind of street food were you eating?
Well, here's the thing, is the food can actually be a little bit expensive. I mean, if you're not eating sort of very basic street food, the restaurants are actually very expensive, but all of the food that we had was very very good. In fact, I want to give a shout out to the place that we ate in around by Portobello for lunch, and it was called Los Cañones, which specializes in seafood.
Cañones is shrimp?
This is everything.
Okay.
So you get a lot of sea bass in this corner of the world, and I forget what the Spanish word for sea bass is, but you get it in like a ceviche, so it's sort of raw fish in lime juice and spices. And it's amazing. And you can get this sea bass ceviche everywhere. But it was a particularly good example here. You can get octopus. I had an octopus ceviche that was just stunning. Octopus is one of my favorite foods on the planet. You can get all different types of white fish that comes fresh off of the sea. So this is a corner of the world where you want to eat seafood. As much seafood as you can possibly eat. Because it's all amazing. And if you can get it on the Caribbean side in particular in this spicy coconut sauce, it's fantastic. Really fantastic.
Excellent.
While we're talking about food, the other thing I should mention is this is beer country.
Oh, okay.
The wines that we noticed, all the restaurants that we went in and we ate at had a wine list, but the wines were astronomically expensive. I never saw a glass of wine for much less than $12 or $14, which is a lot, especially in that corner of the world. But beer would be $2, $2.50, especially if you were drinking the local beer, which is all lager. But it goes great with the food. I mean, it's nothing special, the beer, but it goes well with the food, and it is what you want to be drinking. I did order a glass of wine once thinking I would treat myself, and I did regret it. It was the worst glass of $12 wine I think I've ever had in my life. So drink beer. If you're in Panama, just drink the beer.
Excellent. Before we get to our last two questions, do you have anything else that we should know before we get on a plane and go to Panama?
There's not a lot of guidebooks to Panama. Hmm. I think the Lonely Planet version is in the process of being updated. The version that I saw in all of the shops and on Amazon was like a 2009 version, which is not great. I think it's due to come out sometime in 2014. The book that I used was the Explorer's Guide to Panama, which was slightly more recent, 2011. And even still, some of that stuff was out of date. So, I mean, this is a place where you're going to want to, your guidebooks will always be out of date. So you're going to want to wing it a little bit, because it's quite a dynamic place. Things are opening and closing all the time. So be a little bit adventurous and kind of go with the flow.
Last two questions. You know what's coming. Finish this sentence. You really know you're in Panama when what?
When you've got five different types of ceviche on the menu, and that's just for starters.
And if you had to summarize Panama in three words, which three words would you use?
Diverse, surprising, and historical.
Excellent. Where can people read more about your travels, Chandra?
You can go to my blog, which is www.dragondream.org. It's mostly written by me, but my husband, Stephen, has recently started writing and blogging as well. So depending on when people visit, you will get a mix of voices. You can also see my pictures on my Flickr page. My Flickr ID is OUFoxy, F-O-X-Y.
And I should say that, coincidentally, our trip to Panama was also for a wedding anniversary. It was for a late belated 25th anniversary cruise through the Panama Canal. So apparently that is the place to go. So Chandra, thanks so much for coming back on The Amateur Traveler and telling us about your newfound love for Panama.
Thanks very much, Chris.
As I mentioned, this is the 400th episode of the show. That's cheating just a little bit. I will admit that there were a couple special episodes, live episodes of the show, and I think there may have been another one that wasn't labeled right. So it's really the 400 regular episode of the show, but that's close enough. And one of the things I'd like to do as we get ready for the new year here in 2014, which is when this is coming out, is I'd like to hear from you in terms of what you like in the show and what you haven't liked as much. And so there's a survey up, amateurtraveler.com/survey400. And that survey will give me some insights to make the show better. Now, I will tell you that I'm going to have some problems interpreting the survey because there's at least one guest who has made the list of both favorite shows and least favorite shows. So do with that what you will. I heard from Corey from the Irish Fireside Podcast, who wrote both Mary Jo and I, who was on the episode about Belfast, and said, just wanted to let you know I had just had a chance to listen to the Belfast interview. Great job. Mary Jo, I love that you were able to give your well-rounded, upbeat reaction to the city, and I'm still giddy that we bumped into each other on the streets while there. And thanks so much for writing, Corey. For those of you who haven't checked out Corey's show, if you're interested in going to Ireland, Corey's is definitely the show I would recommend. And Corey and I have known each other for years now by this point. I had the honest thing happen the other week is I have a Google alert set to tell me when people have linked to the Amateur Traveler, and up came a site that was from Taiwan about learning the English language, and almost every word in it was Chinese, and there was just enough English in there to let me see Amateur Traveler and podcast and I think one or two other words. But fortunately, we happened to have living with us a international student who is from Shanghai who translated this. So it was fun to find out that there was this small article on this site that said this. Only 2 years after its first show, it was ranked as one of the top 10 tourism websites in the Chicago Sun-Times in 2007. The podcasts in the show include both tourism information and traveling stories. This introduction focuses on audio episodes and video episodes offered on the website and encourages advanced English learners to practice listening as well as learn more about traveling around the world. And so if you happen to be from Taiwan and an advanced English learner, Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. And lastly, I heard from Jeff, who sent congratulations on the 400th episode and saw that we were recently talking about Flanders. Last month, he went to Verdun, where he also saw where his great uncle was stationed during World War I and found the experience to be very moving. Jeff, thanks for writing. With that, we will end this momentous episode of the Amateur Traveler. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope we're around for 400 more. If you have any questions, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com or leave a comment on this episode at The Amateur Traveler. You can also join the Amateur Traveler Facebook community or follow me on Twitter at Chris2X. But after 400 times, perhaps you knew all that. And so I will leave you with two things. One is, please fill out the survey, amateurtraveler.com/survey400, s'il vous plaît. And as always, thanks so much for listening.